Book today is probably C.S. Lewis's most popular book. That is the one that's been for which he is best known, and the one that has probably sold the most copies. It is his book, The Screwtape Letters, and he wrote it with the same quality of marvelous humor that he displays in a lot of other writings. And got the kind of tongue-in-cheek reviews that maybe the book really deserves to get. I'm tempted to want to read it all. It's awfully hard to put down. But let me we'll do a lot of reading today. What I propose is let me just say a brief word about the nature and character of the book, and then we'll read as many things as we can and talk about as many things as you want to talk about today. Lewis wrote this book in 1941, and it was published in the middle of England's experience with the Second World War. We have to remember that by July of 1941, when he wrote the preface to this book, by July of 1941, England had survived the phony war of the winter of 1939, the debacle of Dunkirk in the spring of 1940, the terrible bombing campaign which Hitler mounted against Germany, which Hitler mounted against England in the late summer and autumn of 1940, survived the continued reverses in North Africa. Rommel had pushed his armies all the way to the gates of Cairo and Alexandria in North Africa, and the invasion of Russia, with Hitler hurtling across the open territory into the heartland of Russia. So, you know, if you think back to those times, some of you can't obviously think back that far, but many of us here remember that. We have to understand that England sustained just enormous blows. The reason I write all of this is because the book presupposes, at least, that you know a little bit of the environment, because in a sense, Lewis does two things in the book. He tells a story, really the story of an individual's life. Wormwood, the devil to whom these letters are all written, ostensibly, has a single individual in his charge, a single person whom he is to seduce into misbelief, despair, and other great shame and vice. And so what you are doing, in a sense, is getting the story of this individual as he lives through these experiences of England, these wartime experiences, and eventually, at the end, we'll see is profoundly affected by the war. So you're getting biography, but written from a curious perspective. One of the things a person always has to ask about a novel, a work of fiction, about an enterprise, is what perspective does the author assume as he is telling the story? And in this case, of course, we're looking at the biography of this individual from the perspective of one who is trying to tempt him. It's an interesting and unusual perspective. And it makes a great deal whether the author is sort of Olympian, looking down on everything, telling you the thoughts of everyone involved, you see, so that you really are seeing more than you would ever see just as an ordinary observer. Or is the author telling you the story from the perspective of one of the participants? Or is he telling you the story? One of the most unusual devices I've ever seen is in Holy Masquerade, where you are reading the diary, Clara's diary, and then her husband's notes, and finally a police report, so that you're getting some of the same incidents from three perspectives, and it's as if you have just sort of picked up a file in a parsonage office after the minister has cleared out, and there is the room, empty room, and here's the file, and you find this file labeled Clara Svensson, and you start sitting down and read three documents just as if you would come upon them. I think it's terribly important to ask from what perspective the story is being told. And in C.S. Lewis, here in the Screwtape Letters, it's being told from the perspective of a devil who's tempting. So you see this man's life unfold from the perspective of one who's tempting him. But the other literary device that Lewis uses here is to write theology not from the perspective of let's say, God, or a spokesman for the Word of God, where you are hearing what God or his spokesman wants you to hear, where you are getting it straight, where you are getting it, where you are having the right things advocated. But here it's just turned around. Everything is reversed, you see. So, and you are seeing it all from what Lewis might imagine, the point of anti-God to be. You are experiencing theology from its opposite, from its enemy, from its opponent. Just a marvelous way to look at things. And it's very provocative. Now, if we keep in mind that Lewis's fictional purpose here tells a story and does theology from the opposite side, then I think we can get some of the flavor of it. Marvelous good humor. In the preface, Lewis writes, "There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence, and the other to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors and hail the materialist and the magician with the same delight. Readers are advised to remember that the devil is a liar. Not everything that Screwtape says should be assumed to be true, even from his own angle. I have made no attempt to identify any of the human beings mentioned in the letters, but I think it unlikely that the portraits of, for example, Father Spike would be a high church Anglican. Spiky was the derogatory term that was directed at excessively liturgical and excessively Roman Catholic leaning Episcopal priests or Anglican priests. So when he alludes to Father Spike, it's a way of identifying a character. The portraits of, say, Father Spike or the patient's mother are wholly just. I think it unlikely that these portraits are wholly just. There is wishful thinking in hell as well as on earth. The history of the European war, except insofar as it happens now and then to impinge upon the spiritual condition of one human being, was obviously of no interest to Screwtape. All right, let's get on with the reading then and just look at some of these letters. "My dear Wormwood, I note what you say about guiding your patient's reading and taking care that he sees a good deal of his materialist friend. But are you not being a trifle naive? It sounds as if you supposed that argument was the way to keep him out of the enemy's clutches." Remember, the enemy is God, all right? Argument was the way. That might have been so had he lived a few centuries earlier. At that time, the humans still knew pretty well when a thing was proved and when it was not. And if it was proved, they really believed it. They still connected thinking with doing and were prepared to alter their way of life as a result of a chain of reasoning. But what with the weekly press and other such weapons, we have largely altered that. Your man has been accustomed, ever since he was a boy, to have a dozen incompatible philosophies dancing about together inside his head. He doesn't think of doctrines as primarily true or false, but as academic or practical, as outworn or contemporary, as conventional or ruthless. Jargon, not argument, is your best ally in keeping him from the church. Don't waste time trying to make him think that materialism is true. Make him think it is strong or stark or courageous. That is the sort of philosophy of the future. That's the sort of thing he cares about." I want to just comment as I'm going along here that Lewis again takes up this theme in a sustained essay in his book, The Abolition of Man, where he is really arguing against the notion that what is primarily important is how we feel about things rather than whether or not they're true. And he thinks if we once stop asking the question of truth or falsity, we will cease to be humans. And if we simply ask ourselves, do they make me feel good or bad, or how do I feel about things, then we have stopped being human beings. Interesting point, and he argues it with great force in The Abolition of Man. But here he's just saying, you see, it's one of the weapons of the enemy. It's one of the devil's weapons to get us to stop asking whether things are true. The trouble about argument, Screwtape goes on, is that it moves the whole struggle onto the enemy's own ground. He can argue too, whereas in really practical propaganda of the kind I'm suggesting, he has been shown for centuries to be greatly in the inferior of our father below. By the very act of arguing, you awake the patient's reason. And once it is awake, who can foresee the result? Even if a particular train of thought can be twisted so as to end in our favor, you will find that you have been strengthening in your patient the fatal habit of attending to universal issues and withdrawing his attention from the stream of immediate sense experience. Your business is to fix his attention on the stream. Teach him to call it real life, and don't let him ask what he means by real. Remember, he is not like you, pure spirit, never having been a human. Oh, that abominable advantage of the enemies. You don't realize how enslaved they are to the pressure of the ordinary. Why, I once had a patient, a sound atheist, who used to read in the British Museum. One day as he sat reading, I saw a train of thought in his mind beginning to go the wrong way. The enemy, of course, was at his elbow in a moment. Before I knew where I was, I saw my 20 years' work beginning to totter. If I had lost my head and begun to attempt a defense by argument, I should have been undone. But I was not such a fool. I struck instantly at the part of the man which I had best under my control and suggested it was just about time he had some lunch. The enemy presumably made the counter-suggestion. You know how one can never quite overhear what he says to them, that this was more important than the lunch. At least I think that must have been his line, for when I said quite, in fact much too important to tackle at the end of a morning, the patient brightened up considerably, and by the time I had added, much better come back after lunch and go into it with a fresh mind, he was already halfway to the door. Once in the street, the battle was won. I showed him a newsboy shouting the midday paper and a number 73 bus going past, and before he reached the bottom of the steps, I had got him into an unalterable conviction that whatever odd idea might come into a man's head when he was shut up alone with his books, a healthy dose of real life, by which he meant the bus and the newsboy, was enough to show him that all that sort of thing just couldn't be true. He knew he'd had a narrow escape. In later years, was fond of talking about that inarticulate sense for actuality, which is our ultimate safeguard against the aberrations of mere logic. He is now safe in our father's house below. You begin to see the point. Thanks to processes which we set at work in them centuries ago, they find it all but impossible to believe in the unfamiliar while the familiar is before their eyes. Keep pressing home on him the ordinariness of things. Above all, do not attempt to use science. I mean the real sciences. As a defense against Christianity, they will positively encourage him to think about realities he can't touch and see. There have been sad cases among modern physicists. If he must dabble in science, keep him on economics and sociology. Don't let him get away from the invaluable real life. But best of all is to let him read no science, but give him a grand general idea that he knows it all and that everything he happens to have picked up in casual talk and reading is the result of modern investigation. Do remember you are trying to fuddle him. From the way some of you young fiends talk, anybody would suppose it was our job to teach your affectionate uncle Screwtape. Ha, ha, ha. Marvelous. All right, in the second letter, he becomes a Christian. All right, please, fire away.
I don't know whether, I thought I understood you, but I can't call the reason. He said, only if we lose our truth and falsehood, then we're no longer human.
If we stop asking the question of truth versus lie, you see. Then we lose our humanity.
But is it logical to think that feeling is not about what other species feels, in a sense, because he's talking about it?
Yes. I think Lewis's main point here is not that we do not feel things, feel good and bad and so on, but that feeling is not a very reliable guide for us. I think that's a fundamentally, I think it's a fundamentally Lutheran notion, to say the least. Luther would say that that our feeling about our relationship to God is really no accurate barometer to the validity of that relationship, and that we need to look at other objective, that is, at realities outside of ourselves.
But Luther would not give in to a purely rational viewpoint of God, would he?
I guess it depends on what you mean by a purely rational.
A proof.
I don't think that that's what Lewis is saying either. I think Lewis is saying that the question of the truth or falsity of something does not depend on how we feel about it. That we can feel profoundly good about things that can be terribly false, and we can feel profoundly bad about things that can be very true. And that one might want to do them, let's say, even if one didn't feel like doing them because they were right or true. That's Lewis's point.
That I can accept. That.
Okay, and I
we're not human because we feel.
Well, the argument in the abolition of man is more involved than I've indicated here. But what he is trying to say is that that we are really on a path of self-destruction as human if we do not hang on to the question of is it true, hang on to that question rather than how do I feel about it. And that's what he's saying here too.
Okay, all right.
I'm sure he's not simply trying to say all of human existence is rational existence. I know Lewis wouldn't want to say that, but I think he is trying to say, at least he's having Screwtape say here, the question of that the goal of temptation is definitely not aided if a person asks the question of the truth of something. For if you do, if you really are serious about pursuing the truth, you may actually find it. You see, whereas if your only concern is how you feel about things, you may never find the truth, which is precisely what this tempter wants to achieve. Just back to Luther again for a moment. Luther always went to objective realities as an aid against temptation. When he would feel that God was against him, he would say, but that can't be because I'm baptized, you see. That is, something's been done to me. And in my baptism, I have been claimed and marked as God's own. And that's what I have to cling to, no matter how I feel at the moment. Or he would say, when you are tempted to fudge on the word of God, remember your ordination. Remember, you are under orders to say the truth, even if it is not particularly comfortable for you or for the people who hear the word. That's, I think, a much needed word. It's the worst temptation that I have and had was to look out over my congregation on Sunday morning when I was in the pulpit and see Gertrude Lansing and Emil Bolinski and Paul Smith and Will Hank, and then I would do one of two things. I would either leave out whole paragraphs of my sermon, or I would say them in such a way that I know I wasn't being understood, and then I had the advantage of having said the truth without having to pay the consequences, which was always the nicest way to go. I think one of the best sermons I ever preached was a sermon in which James Gray got up out of the fourth pulpit and stormed down the aisle out of the church. And we had some very good conversation after that, and I knew I wasn't fudging. He understood me. That's why he got mad and left. Well, I think that's Lewis's point. Pardon, did somebody want to say something?
Could Lewis or Luther, either one, say that you shouldn't base your, I don't know if they shouldn't, but would say that it was not good to base your faith on emotions or feeling that?
Oh, yes. Both would say.
Objectively based on the world around you. And
well, I think Lewis would say, the question?
Yeah.
Would Lewis, go ahead.
Would Lewis or Luther say that you should not, not should not, but it would be particularly bad to base your faith on strictly emotion or feeling rather than objective ideas of life around you?
Yeah, both of them would say definitely yes to that. They would say the word that makes you feel good ought to make you be suspicious right off, because the gospel never enters a vacuum. It always enters occupied territory, and there's going to be opposition to the word of God. So it may well be that when we are invited to feel something, we may be already well on the road towards seduction. Commercials on television are more designed to appeal to our emotions than to our reason. See, we are encouraged to buy things that rationally we do not need, that logically don't make sense frequently. Advertisers, too, don't really want us to think too much about what they say. One of the games that we play at our house when we do listen to commercials is just to expose the logical fallacies in commercials. One of my favorites is a manna. If it's not a manna, it isn't a radar range. I mean, just think about how stupid that statement is, you know. But you're expected to believe that something very profound is being said here, you know. And this lovely woman who does these commercials says it with such sincerity, you know. But it's really logically absurd. If it's not a manna, it's not a radar range. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's a total nonsense statement, right?
Because radar range is the brand name.
Yes. And a manna is the corporation that makes it, you know. But you're expected to believe, you see, that something really significant is being added to your store of knowledge. Well, it isn't. It's like saying if it's not a Chevrolet, it isn't a Chevette or something, you know. It's crazy. Well, one could go on and on, but advertisers are really not attempting you to raise the truth or false question. All right. Let's go on. Next letter. My dear Wormwood. Wormwood is the junior tempter. Screwtape is writing the letters. On the back of my edition, at least, C.S. Lewis has supplied a drawing, His Infernal Excellency, Mr. Screwtape, as imagined by the author, C.S. Lewis. It's a slight advantage you get if you get an older edition. The newer paperbacks are cheaper, but no art. Okay. My dear Wormwood, I note with grave displeasure that your patient has become a Christian. Do not indulge the hope that you will escape the usual penalties. Indeed, in your better moments, I trust you would hardly even wish to do so. In the meantime, we must make the best of the situation. There is no need to despair. Hundreds of these adult converts have been reclaimed after a brief sojourn in the enemy's camp and are now with us. All the habits of the patient, both mental and bodily, are still in our favor. One of our great allies at present is the church itself. Do not misunderstand me. I do not mean the church as we see her spread out through all time and space and rooted in eternity, terrible as an army with banners. That, I must confess, is a spectacle which makes our boldest tempters uneasy. But fortunately, it is quite invisible to these humans. All your patient sees is the half-finished sham Gothic erection on the new building estate. When he goes inside, he sees the local grocer, with rather an oily expression on his face, bustling up to offer him one shiny little book containing a liturgy which neither of them understands, and one shabby little book containing corrupt texts of a number of religious lyrics, mostly bad and in very small print. When he gets to his pew and looks around him, he sees just that selection of his neighbors whom he has hitherto avoided. You want to lean pretty heavily on those neighbors, make his mind flip to and fro between an expression like the body of Christ and the actual faces in the next pew. It matters very little, of course, what kind of people that next pew really contains. You may know one of them to be a great warrior on the enemy's side, no matter. Your patient, thanks to our Father below, is a fool, provided that any of those neighbors sing out of tune, or have boots that squeak, or double chins, or odd clothes. The patient will quite easily believe that their religion must therefore be somehow ridiculous. In his present stage, you see, he has an idea of Christians in his mind, which he supposes to be spiritual, but which in fact is largely pictorial. His mind is full of togas and sandals and armor and bare legs, and the mere fact that the other people in church wear modern clothes is a real, though of course an unconscious, difficulty to him. Never let it come to the surface. Never let him ask what he expected them to look like. Keep everything hazy in his mind now, and you will have all eternity wherein to amuse yourself by producing in him the peculiar kind of clarity which hell affords. Work hard, then, on the disappointment or anticlimax which is certainly coming to the patient during his first few weeks as a churchman. The enemy allows this disappointment to occur on the threshold of every human endeavor. It occurs when the boy who has been enchanted in the nursery by stories from the Odyssey buckles down to really learning Greek. It occurs when lovers have got married and the real task of learning to live and begin the real task of learning to live together. In every department of life, it marks the transition from dreaming aspiration to laborious doing. The enemy takes this risk because he has a curious fantasy of making all these disgusting little human vermin into what he calls his free lovers and servants. Sons is the word he uses, with his inveterate love of degrading the whole spiritual world by unnatural liaisons with the two-legged animals. Desiring their freedom, he therefore refuses to carry them by their mere affections and habits to any of the goals which he sets before them. He leaves them to do it on their own, and there lies our opportunity. But also remember, there lies our danger. If once they get through this initial dryness successfully, they become much less dependent on emotion, and therefore much harder to tempt. I have been writing hitherto on the assumption that the people in the next pew afford no rational ground for disappointment. Of course, if they do, if the patient knows that the woman with the absurd hat is a fanatical bridge player, or the man with squeaky boots is a miser and an extortioner, then your task is so much easier. All you have to do is to keep out of his mind the question, if I, being what I am, can consider that I am in some sense a Christian, why should the different vices of those people in the next pew prove that their religion is mere hypocrisy and convention? You may ask whether it is possible to keep such an obvious thought from occurring even to a human mind. It is, Wormwood, it is. Handle him properly, and it simply won't come into his head. He has not been anything like long enough with the enemy to have any real humility yet. What he says, even on his knees, about his own sinfulness is still all parrot talk. At bottom, he still believes he has run up a very favorable credit balance in the enemy's ledger by allowing himself to be converted, and he thinks that he is showing great humility and condescension in going to church with these smug, commonplace neighbors at all. Keep him in that state of mind as long as you can. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape. Oh, marvelous. All right, let's, number three. My dear Wormwood, by what you tell me about this man's relation with his... I'm pleased by what you tell me about this man's relation with his mother, but you must press your advantage. The enemy will be working from the center outwards, gradually bringing more and more of the patient's conduct under the new standard, and may reach his behavior to the old lady at any moment. You want to get in first. Keep in close touch with our colleague Glubos, who is in charge of the mother, and build up between you and that house a good settled habit of mutual annoyance. Daily pinpricks. The following methods are useful. Keep his mind on the inner life. He thinks his conversion is something inside him, and his attention is therefore chiefly turned at present to the states of his own mind, or rather to that very expurgated version of them which is all you should allow him to see. Encourage this. keep his mind off the most elementary duties by directing it to the most advanced spiritual ones, aggravate that most useful human characteristic, the horror and neglect of the obvious. You must bring him to a condition in which he can practice self-examination for an hour without discovering any of those facts about himself which are perfectly clear to anyone who has ever lived in the same house with him or worked in the same office. Secondly, it is no doubt impossible to prevent his praying for his mother, but we have means of rendering the prayers innocuous. Make sure they are always very spiritual, that he is always concerned with the state of her soul and never with her rheumatism. Two advantages will follow. In the first place, his attention will be kept on what he regards as her sins, by which, with a little guidance from you, he can be induced to mean any of her actions which are inconvenient or irritating to himself. Thus, you can keep rubbing the wounds of the day a little sorer, even while he is on his knees. The operation is not at all difficult, and you will find it very entertaining. In the second place, since his ideas about her soul will be very crude and often erroneous, he will in some degree be praying for an imaginary person, and it will be your task to make that imaginary person daily less and less like the real mother, the sharp-tongued old lady at the breakfast table. In time, you may get the cleavage so wide that no thought or feeling from his prayers for the imagined mother will ever flow over into his treatment of the real one. I have had patients of my own so well in hand that they could be turned at a moment's notice from impassioned prayer for a wife or son's soul to beating or insulting the real wife or son without a qualm. Third, when two humans have lived together for many years, it usually happens that each has tones of voice and expressions of face which are almost unendurably irritating to the other. Work on that. Bring fully into the consciousness of your patient that particular lift of his mother's eyebrows which he learned to dislike in the nursery, and let him think how much he dislikes it. Let him assume that she knows how annoying it is and does it to annoy. If you know your job, he will not notice the immense improbability of the assumption. And of course, never let him suspect that he has tones and looks which similarly annoy her. As he cannot see or hear himself, this is easily managed. And fourth, in civilized life, domestic hatred usually expresses itself by saying things which would appear quite harmless on paper. The words are not offensive, but saying them in such a voice or at such a moment that they are not far short of a blow in the face. To keep this game up, you and Glubos must see to it that each of these two fools has a sort of double standard. Your patient must demand that all his own utterances are to be taken at their face value and judged simply on the actual words, while at the same time judging all his mother's utterances with the fullest and most oversensitive interpretation of the tone and the context and the suspected intention. She must be encouraged to do the same to him. Hence, from every quarrel, they can both go away convinced, or very nearly convinced, that they are quite innocent. You know the kind of thing. I simply ask her what time dinner will be, and she flies into a temper. Once this habit is well established, you have the delightful situation of a human saying things with the express purpose of offending, and yet having a grievance when offense is taken. Finally, tell me something about the old lady's religious position. Is she at all jealous of the new factor in her son's life? All piqued that he should have learned from others and so late what she considers she gave him such good opportunity of learning in childhood? Does she feel he is making a great deal of fuss about it, or that he is getting in on very easy terms? Remember the elder brother in the enemy's story. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape. Ah.
Was any of that directed toward the lady he was taking care of?
I've often wondered that. That's a good question. He says here, it is very unlikely that the portraits of the patient's mother are wholly just. But I suspect that, obviously, he incorporates in his writing some of his own experiences. And I'm sure what he's trying to do here is, of course, to maybe write to himself, to recall himself to paying attention to the obvious and the ordinary in his relationship with Mrs. Moore, and not to let the petty annoyances that inevitably arise when people live close together to intrude, you know. So I just read this and think, how did he know so much about, you know, how I get along with my wife or or she with me, which is even harder to imagine. Well, I'm going to, let's skip on. I'd like to turn to some of the, oh, here's one. Number six. My dear Wormwood, I'm delighted to hear that your patient's age and profession make it possible, but by no means certain, that he will be called up for military service. We want him to be in the maximum uncertainty, so that his mind will be filled with contradictory pictures of the future, every one of which arouses hope or fear. There is nothing like suspense and anxiety for barricading a human's mind against the enemy. He wants men to be concerned with what they do. Our business is to keep them thinking about what will happen to them. Your patient will, of course, have picked up the notion that he must submit with patience to the enemy's will. What the enemy means by this is primarily they should accept with patience the tribulation which has actually been dealt out to him, the present anxiety and suspense. It is about this that he is to say, "Thy will be done," and for the daily task of bearing this that the daily bread will be provided. It is your business to see that the patient never thinks of the present fear as his appointed cross, but only of the things he is afraid of. Let him regard them as his crosses. Let him forget that since they are incompatible, they can't all happen to him. And let him try to pray, practice fortitude and patience to them all in advance. For real resignation at the same moment to a dozen different and hypothetical fates is almost impossible. And the enemy does not greatly assist those who are trying to attain it. Resignation to present, actual suffering, even where that suffering consists of fear, is far easier and is usually helped by this direct action. An important spiritual law is here involved. I have explained that you can weaken his prayers by diverting his attention from the enemy himself to his own states of mind about the enemy. On the other hand, fear becomes easier to master when the patient's mind is diverted from the thing feared to the fear itself, considered as a present and undesirable state of his own mind. And when he regards the fear as his appointed cross, he will inevitably think of it as a state of mind. One can therefore formulate the general rule, in all activities of the mind which favor our cause, encourage the patient to be unself-conscious and to concentrate on the object. But in all activities favorable to the enemy, bend his mind back on itself. Let an insult or a woman's body so fix his attention outward that he does not reflect, "I am now entering into the state called anger or the state called lust." Contrarywise, let the reflection, "My feelings are now growing more devout or more charitable," so fix his attention on his feelings that he no longer looks beyond himself to see the enemy or his own neighbors. As regards his more general attitude toward the war, you must not rely too much on those feelings of hatred which the humans are so fond of discussing in Christian periodicals. In his anguish, the patient can, of course, be encouraged to revenge himself by some vindictive feelings directed toward the German leaders, and that is good so far as it goes, but it is usually a sort of melodramatic or mythical hatred directed against imaginary scapegoats. He has never met these people in real life. They are lay figures modeled on what he gets from the newspapers. The results of such fanciful hatred are often most disappointing, and of all humans, the English are in this respect the most deplorable milksops. They are creatures of that miserable sort who loudly proclaim that torture is too good for their enemies, and then give tea and cigarettes to the first wounded German pilot who turns up at the back door. Do what you will, there is going to be some benevolence as well as some malice in your patient's soul. The great thing is to direct the malice toward his immediate neighbors, whom he meets every day, and to thrust his benevolence to the remote circumference, to people he does not know. The malice thus becomes wholly real, and the benevolence largely imaginary. There is no good at all in flaming his hatred of Germans if at the same time a pernicious habit of charity is growing up between him and his mother, his employer, or the man he meets in the train. Think of your man in a series of concentric circles, his will being the innermost, his intellect coming next, and finally his fantasy. You can hardly hope at once to exclude from all the circles everything that smells of the enemy, but you must keep on shoving all the virtues outward till they are finally located in the circle of fantasy, and all the desirable qualities inward into the will. It is only insofar as they reach the will that they are embodied in habits, that the virtues are really fatal to us. I don't, of course, mean what the patient mistakes for his will, the conscious fume and fret of resolutions and clenched teeth, but I mean the real center, what the enemy calls the heart. All sorts of virtues painted in the fantasy, or approved by the intellect, or even in some measure loved and admired, will not keep a man from our Father's house. Indeed, they make him more amusing when he gets there. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape. In other words, it's much better for us to imagine virtues than to practice them, and that makes us more delectable in hell. Well, let me turn near the end and read some of these from the end. Here's one, 22. My dear Wormwood, so your man is in love, and in the worst kind he could possibly have fallen into, with a girl who does not even appear in the report you sent me. You may be interested to learn that the little misunderstanding with the secret police which you tried to raise about some unguarded expression in one of my letters has been tided over. If you were reckoning on that to secure my good offices, you will find yourself mistaken. You shall pay for that, as well as for your other blunders. Meanwhile, I enclose a little booklet, just issued, on the new House of Correction for Incompetent Tempters. It is profusely illustrated, and you will not find a dull page in it. I have looked up this girl's dossier, and am horrified at what I find. Not only a Christian, but such a Christian, a vile, sneaking, simpering, demure, monosyllabic, mouse-like, waterly, insignificant, virginal bread-and-butter miss, the little brute. She makes me vomit. She stinks and scalds through the very pages of the dossier. It drives me mad the way the world has worsened. We'd have had her to the arena in the old days. That's what her sort is made for. Not that she do much good there either. A two-faced little cheat, I know the sort, who looks as if she'd faint at the sight of blood and then dies with a smile. A cheat every way. Looks as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth and yet has a satirical wit. The sort of creature who'd find me funny. Filthy, insipid, little prude, and yet ready to fall into this booby's arms like any other breeding animal. Why doesn't the enemy blast her for it if he's so moonstruck on virginity, instead of looking on there grinning? Oh, he's a hedonist at heart. All those fasts and vigils and stakes and crosses are only a facade, or only like foam on the seashore. Out at sea, out in his sea, there is pleasure, and more pleasure. He makes no secret of it. At his right hand are pleasures forevermore. Ugh! I don't think he has the very least inkling of that high and austere mystery to which we rise in the miserific vision. He's vulgar, Wormwood. He has a bourgeois mind. He's filled his world full of pleasures. There are things for humans to do all day long without his minding in the least. Sleeping, washing, eating, drinking, making love, playing, praying, working. Everything has to be twisted before it's any use to us. We fight under cruel disadvantage. Nothing natural is on our side. Not that that excuses you. I'll settle with you presently. You've always hated me and been insolent when you dared. And then, of course, he gets to know this woman's family in whole circle. Could you not see that the very house she lives in is one that he ought never to have entered? The whole place reeks of that deadly odor. The very gardener, though he has only been there 5 years, is beginning to acquire it. Even guests, after a weekend visit, carry some of the smell away with them. The dog and the cat are tainted with it. The house full of the impenetrable mystery. We are certain it is a matter of first principles that each member of the family must in some way be making capital out of the others, but we can't find out how. They guard as jealously as the enemy himself the secret of what really lies behind this pretense of disinterested love. The whole house and garden is one vast obscenity. It bears a sickening resemblance to the description one human writer made of heaven. The regions where there is only life, and therefore all that is not music, is silence.
Music and silence, how I detest them both! How thankful we should be that ever since our father'd entered hell, though longer ago than humans reckoning in light years could express, no square inch of infernal space, no moment of infernal time has been surrendered to either of those abominable forces, but all has been occupied by noise. Noise, the grand dynamism, the audible expression of all that is exultant, ruthless, virile, noise which alone defends us from silly qualms, despairing scruples, impossible desires. We will make the whole universe a noise in the end. We have already made great strides in this direction as regards the earth. The melodies and silences of heaven will be shouted down in the end, but I admit we are not yet loud enough for anything like it. Research is in progress. Meanwhile, you disgusting little... Here the manuscript breaks off and is resumed in a different hand. In the heat of composition, I find I have inadvertently allowed myself to assume the form of a large centipede. I am accordingly dictating the rest to my secretary. Now that the transformation is complete, I recognize it as a periodical phenomenon. Some rumor of it has reached the humans, and a distorted account of it appears in the poet Milton, with the ridiculous addition that such changes of shape are a punishment imposed on us by the enemy. A more modern writer, someone with a name like Pshaw, has, however, grasped the truth. Transformation proceeds from within and is a glorious manifestation of that life force which our father would worship if he worshipped anything but himself. In my present form, I feel even more anxious to see you, to unite you to myself in an indissoluble embrace. Signed, Toadpipe, for his abysmal sublimity, Under Secretary Screwtape, TEBS, etc. That's a marvelous letter. I think we've got time for one more. I think I'd like to read the last one. He says, now it is certain that the Germans will bombard your patient's town, etc. Here is the last one. My dear, my very dear Wormwood, my poppet, my pig's knee, how miserably now that all is lost you come whimpering to ask me whether the terms of affection in which I address you meant nothing from the beginning. Far from it. Rest assured, my love for you and your love for me are as like as two peas. I have always desired you as you, pitiful fool, desired me. The difference is that I am the stronger. I think they will give you to me now, or a bit of you. Love you? Why, yes, as dainty a morsel as I ever grew fat on. You have let a soul slip through your fingers. The howl of sharpened famine for that loss re-echoes at this moment through all the levels of the kingdom of noise, down to the very throne itself. It makes me mad to think of it. How well I know what happened at the instant when they snatched him from you. There was a sudden clearing in his eyes, was there not? As he saw you for the first time and recognized the part you had had in him and knew that you had it no longer. Just think, and let it be the beginning of your agony, what he felt at that moment, as if a scab had fallen from an old sore, as if he were emerging from a hideous shell-like tetter, as if he shuffled off for good all a defiled, wet, clinging garment. By hell, it is misery enough to see them in their mortal days taking off dirtied, uncomfortable clothes, splashing in hot water, giving little grunts of pleasure, stretching their eased limbs. Sounds like he's been to the jacuzzi. What then of this final stripping, this complete cleansing? The more one thinks about it, the worse it becomes. He got through so easily. No gradual misgivings, no doctor's sentence, no nursing home, no operating theater, no false hopes of life. Just sheer, instantaneous liberation. One moment and it seemed to be all our world. The scream of bombs, the fall of houses, the stink and taste of high explosive on the lips and in the lungs, the feet burning with weariness, the heart cold with horrors, the brain reeling, the legs aching. And the next moment, all this gone. Gone like a bad dream, never again to be of any account. Defeated, outmaneuvered fool! Did you mark how naturally, as if he'd been born for it, the earth-born vermin entered the new life? How all his doubts became, in the twinkling of an eye, ridiculous? I know what the creature was saying to itself. Yes, of course, it always was like this. All horrors have followed the same course, getting worse and worse and forcing you into a kind of bottleneck till at the very moment when you thought you must be crushed, behold, you were out of the narrows and all was suddenly well. The extraction hurt more and more, and then the tooth was out. The dream became a nightmare, and then you woke. You die and die, and then you are beyond death. How could I have ever doubted it? That's what he was saying. As he saw you, he also saw them. I know how it was. You reeled back, dizzy, blinded, more hurt by them than he had ever been by bombs. The degradation of it, that this thing of earth and slime could stand upright and converse with spirits before whom you, a spirit, could only cower. Perhaps you had hoped that the awe and strangeness of it would dash his joy, but that's the cursed thing. The gods are strange to mortal eyes, and yet they are not strange. He had no faintest conception till that very hour of how they would look, and even doubted their existence. But when he saw them, he knew that he had always known them, and realized what part each one of them had played at many an hour in his life when he had supposed himself alone, so that now he could say to them one by one, not, "Who are you?" but, "So it was you all the time." All that they were and said at this meeting woke memories, the dim consciousness of friends about him, which had haunted his solitudes from infancy, was now at last explained, that central music in every pure experience which had always just evaded memory, was now at last recovered. Recognition made him free of their company almost before the limbs of his corpse became quiet. Only you were left outside. He saw not only them, he saw him. This animal, this thing begotten in a bed, could look on him. What is blinding, suffocating fire to you is now cool light to him, is clarity itself, and wears the form of a man. You would like, if you could, to interpret the patient's prostration in the presence, his self-abhorrence, and utter knowledge of his sins. Yes, Wormwood, a clearer knowledge even than yours, on the analogy of your own choking, paralyzing sensations when you encounter the deadly air that breathes from the heart of heaven. But it's all nonsense. Pains he may still have to encounter, but they embrace those pains. They would not barter them for any earthly pleasure. All the delights of sense or heart or intellect with which you could once have tempted him, even the delights of virtue itself, now seemed to him in comparison but as the half-nauseous attractions of a rattled harlot would seem to a man who hears that his true beloved, whom he has loved all his life, and whom he had believed to be dead, is alive, and even now at his door. He's caught up into that world where pain and pleasure take on transfinite values, and all our arithmetic is dismayed. Once more the inexplicable meets us. Next to the curse of useless tempters like yourself, the greatest curse upon us is the failure of our intelligence department. If only we could find out what he is really up to. Alas, alas, that knowledge, in itself so hateful and mawkish a thing, should yet be necessary for power. Sometimes I am almost in despair. All that sustains me is the conviction that our realism, our rejection in the face of all temptations, of all silly nonsense and claptrap, must win in the end. Meanwhile, I have you to settle with. Most truly do I sign myself your increasingly and ravenously affectionate uncle, Screwtape. That's where it ends. Well, a marvelous book. I hope you... How many of you have read it already? Can I see hands? Well, I hope those of you who haven't will be moved to read it, because it's really exciting. I think it's one of his marvelous creations. Well, it's 5 o'clock. The bell's going to ring. Tomorrow we will do The Great Divorce here. Same time, same place. Okay? Thank you.